Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the show where we host quick conversations on news of the week. Later in the program, we'll hear from an Iowa State lawmaker who's been working alongside her newborn baby at the State House. Also, a preview of the United World Wrestling Men's Freestyle World Cup that's being hosted in Iowa City this weekend. But first, let's talk about arguably the biggest news of the week. We heard it at the top of the hour, the ongoing trade dispute between the U.S. and China. After several retaliatory announcements on tariffs back and forth between the two countries, President Trump announced yesterday that he kind of escalated the dispute by announcing tariffs on an additional $100 billion worth of Chinese products. China responded by saying it will fight back, quote, at any cost. Here with me now to explain how we got here and the potential impact on Iowa's farmers is IPR and Harvest Public Media ag reporter. Hi, Amy Mayer.
Hi, Emily.
So, you know, remind us briefly how we got here.
The real dispute in trade between the United States and China doesn't actually have a lot to do with pork or soybeans. The United States has accused China of violating World Trade Organization rules, particularly having to do with intellectual property and also technology transfer and the ways that companies are, some would say, forced to do business in China. Or if they want to do business there, there are certain ways they have to comply with Chinese expectations. So in response to that, which is something the WTO is going to, you know, work through its processes, the United States and China, or the United States has begun this back and forth over tariffs because they don't think that China is complying with those rules and wants to see action on China's part even before anything works its way all the way through the WTO.
Mm-hmm. And
I would just add, and also the administration would argue that these efforts are also aimed at bringing back some of the manufacturing sectors in the U.S. that have seen job losses over the past many years.
Mm-hmm. And so farmers in Iowa are keeping an eye on this, specifically soybean and pork producers, because a lot of our soybean and pork production goes to China. And in your reporting, you talked with a Nevada farmer, Howard Hill. He produces corn, soybeans, cattle, and hogs. What was on his mind when you met him at his farm?
Initially, I went to talk with him about the pork tariff, which went into effect this week. And his concern was that in an environment where farmers have already been dealing with very thin margins, something in the global marketplace that affects the availability of destinations for American agricultural products could be harmful. So if China doesn't want to buy as much pork from us because it's going to cost them more, that will mean U.S. farmers have one country less to sell their pork to, and China's a big buyer. But as things heated up and it became clear that China was willing to put on the table the possibility of also putting this import tax on our soybeans, Howard Hill was saying that would have an even bigger impact on many more farmers, and soybeans are a much bigger dollar value export for American farmers than pork is.
Mm-hmm. And he said that he's seen hog prices drop to the point where it may cost some farmers more to raise a pig than they can sell for. Is that what we're headed for?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, for livestock and for grain, at different times in the past several years, we have seen that prices have been quite low, and whether farmers are going to exceed the cost of production has been a question for the past several seasons. Pork production obviously happens year-round versus crops where you're planting in the spring and harvesting in the fall. But there's definitely been this concern that the lower prices could really make it impossible for some farmers to stay in business.
Mm-hmm. And we have a little over a minute left. I want to ask you before you head out, Senator Joni Ernst says she's concerned that the president isn't keeping the promises he made to Iowa farmers. Do you see some pushback against President Trump coming from Iowa in the near future?
Well, in addition to Senator Ernst, Senator Grassley has also spoken out, not just this week, but up leading up to this week about whether Trump is, in fact, keeping farmers' interests and needs top of mind. There is some concern there that farm state lawmakers maybe haven't been as successful as they'd like in pushing for an agenda that puts agriculture closer to the top of the priority list. But as far as individual farmers, I think in a variety of conversations that I've heard on NPR and on our airwaves, farmers are not coming out in any kind of large number to say that they're, you know, going to turn their back on Trump or not vote for Republicans. So I think it's a concern, but I wouldn't say it's going to have, I don't think there's any indications yet that it's going to have a huge impact on decision making come November or 2020.
All right. Amy Mayer, she's a reporter with Harvest Public Media and with Iowa Public Radio. You can follow her reporting at iowapublicradio.org or follow her on Twitter. Her handle is @AgAmyInAmes. Amy, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure, Emily. Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. It's time for a check-in with IPR's State House reporter, as we like to do on Fridays during the legislative session. IPR correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Emily.
Hi. So we spoke a few weeks ago on our Legislative Monday program about a bill that would direct local governments to comply with federal immigration authorities or risk losing state funding. And from your reporting, it sounds like there is some pretty heated debate as the bill moved forward this week.
It was really controversial. It's a law and order bill. It's a respect for the law bill that's offered by the GOP. Democrats feel that it is insulting to immigrants. They argue that it will harm the relationship between immigrant communities and the police. So it was a very lengthy debate, a very emotional debate. But that bill is on its way to the governor now. Another emotional debate in the Senate. And the governor has indicated that she will sign the bill. She has actually done some fundraising on the basis of this bill, sent a fundraising letter out saying that the bill is needed to stop the liberalism in Des Moines and Iowa City. Iowa City has an ordinance that will prevent the use of local funds to enforce immigration laws. That's close enough to a sanctuary law for Republican opponents of that. So it's just been a very controversial thing.
Mm. Well, in my experience producing legislative days, usually you see a good amount of lobbyists on kind of either side of the bill, either opposing or supporting. But for this bill, the only group registered in support of this bill is the Iowa Minutemen Defense Corps. Can you remember a bill in recent history that's been successful despite, you know, lobbyist opposition to it?
Well, you know, the collective bargaining bill last year that was so controversial, there was very few people who were registered in favor of that bill, while there were many, many, many people registered against it. So that would be another example of a GOP initiative that the Republican lawmakers would say that the general public supports this, even though the list of registered lobbyists does not seem to support it.
Well, and, you know, as we again talked about on our show the other day, no Iowa cities have come out as sanctuary cities. I mean, what impact do you see this law having in the future? Do you see it maybe even going to the courts, possibly?
I suppose that it could be the subject of a court challenge. I think what the critics of this bill argued, it's a solution in search of a problem. And so it's hard to imagine really what kind of effect it's going to have, given, as you said, that there are no Iowa communities who are sanctuary cities. But, you know, the backers of the bill say that it's designed to prevent that from happening. You may recall the quote from the bill's main backer. He said, we don't want any Iowa town to turn into a San Francisco. So it's a preventative measure, in their words.
Talking with IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Another story you reported on this week, a bookstore tax. Currently, university-owned campus bookstores, they enjoy a sales tax exemption, so students can buy books and supplies without worrying about, you know, sales tax. And a bill that advanced in the Iowa House this week would eliminate that tax exemption. Tell me about this.
Well, it pits local you know, sort of Main Street businesses against these tax-free purchases on campus. So in particular, a private bookstore in Iowa City, Iowa Book, they made a very strong case that they're in competition with this the tax-free purchases on campus. So they said that professors would, when they put out their required reading list, everybody's aware of how expensive textbooks are, and so professors were actually reminding students that you can buy this book on campus without paying sales tax. And that's harming the business for Iowa Book. They even suggested that they might be going out of business. So of course, bookstores are in have tremendous competition right now from the internet. We all buy books on the internet now, and so that's a the force working against a private privately run bookstore. But at any rate, there was some unhappiness in the legislature. Republicans in the legislature who felt like the university should have advised them or told them before they put this sales tax exemption into effect. The universities say we consulted with the Department of Revenue. This is spelled out. It's an exemption in Iowa law. But at any rate, it looks like the sales tax exemption is going to go away for everything except textbooks. Everyone seems to agree that you shouldn't have to pay sales tax on textbooks, and so the sales exemption on textbooks is going to stay for universities, but everything else are going to have to pay taxes on, and that includes, everything else, supplies. Somebody was making the point that, you buy a laptop computer, the sales tax that goes on that, and everybody needs a laptop, so it's kind of a compromise that they've struck.
Coming up on Monday, you'll be co-hosting River to River with IPR Morning Edition host Clay Masters. You're going to be discussing a plan that aims to correct some of the problems we've been hearing about relating to Iowa's Medicaid system. Give a brief preview of that conversation.
Well, there is legislation now that is advanced in the Iowa House this week to provide some new oversight for Iowa's privatized Medicaid system. Honestly, every legislator, I believe, has heard from someone in their district who's unhappy with privatized Medicaid. So that's this is a bipartisan thing. Everyone has heard these complaints, among other things, from providers who say they are not being paid promptly. So after a couple of attempts, there is a bill out there now to provide some new oversight for the Medicaid program. We'll be talking about that and about the prospects for that bill. It is bipartisan, advancing in the Iowa House by a unanimous vote in a committee. Some hesitance in the Senate on this because of the price tag on this bill. This bill would put some new auditing into place. The state would hire a private auditor to audit some of these payments to providers, and that costs money. And so the bill is already being scaled back because of the price tag on it, but it does look like they are going to approve some new oversight for Medicaid, and we'll be talking about that on the program on Monday.
All right. IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell, we'll hear from you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Okay. Thanks, Emily.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Joining me next is someone who's been our go-to person for analysis on weather patterns and what they can tell us about our changing climate, how crops will grow, and what kind of season we'll have here in Iowa. After 30 years in the role, our state climatologist Harry Hilliker has retired. He joins me now to talk about his career and what he's observed in Iowa over the past few decades. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for having me on.
So I read that you can sometimes be confused for a meteorologist, but that's something that you have no interest in. So really quick, first off, what's the difference between a climatologist and a meteorologist?
Well, it can be a very confusing distinction there because, in fact, my predecessor, Paul Waite, had been a state climatologist just about as long as I was a meteorologist by training and moved over towards the climatology end of things. And basically, it's kind of a continuum. Meteorology, generally looking at the state of the atmosphere at any one point in time for the most part, mostly for the purpose of making forecasts and things of that nature. Well, climatology takes more of a longer-term view, more historical and statistics and so forth as far as what has happened, what is happening now, and And to some degree, there's not a whole lot to go on sometimes, looking forward to what may be happening more in the longer term.
I read that by age 12 that you were tracking daily weather statistics. That is not a typical hobby for a 12-year-old. Did you know that?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely not. But back when I grew up in Texas, in Fort Worth to be specific, in North Texas, and when I was just 7 years old, we had a full-fledged blizzard and 14 inches of snow in my front yard. And say the least, we didn't get snow very often down there. And basically was watching the weather every evening to see when it was going to snow again next. And had to wait like 3 years before we had any snow of any consequence after that blizzard. But really got me hooked and started taking my own weather observations at a very young age. And always liked working with numbers, so weather kind of fit in very well with that interest, and I've been doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And you were in Fort Worth as a child when you saw your first tornado, right? Tell me about that.
Yes, I was in sixth grade, and back then sixth grade was still in elementary school. They hadn't had the middle school transition going on back at that time. But I was out at recess and looking up, and they wouldn't really expect to see severe weather, but looked up, and there is a funnel basically directly overhead. You look up inside the funnel, up into the cloud, and it was pretty exciting. Oddly enough, wasn't frightening just because it was still a ways above ground, and just didn't look all that threatening. So ran inside to tell my homeroom teacher, there's a tornado outside, which wasn't quite right. It was more of a funnel cloud. It hadn't touched down yet. But anyway, she didn't believe me. So ran down to the principal's office, and he knew I was a weather nut, and he did believe me. So I, rang the bell and had all the, had to go into shelter, and which there isn't much of in most Texas buildings. But had to go in the hall and cover heads, all that stuff, and I was kind of disappointed because I wanted to see where that that funnel cloud was going to go. It did eventually touch down, but it was all over with by the time we got to get out of school. So
Harry, your first year on the job was in 1988. This was one of the driest years in Iowa since the Great Depression. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was a very dry summer and year, so to speak, and a very hot summer as well. And Paul Waite, my predecessor, had retired in February of '88, and I was temporarily appointed acting state climatologist when he left. And it didn't take long. By March and April, things were looking already unusually warm, unusually dry, and it just got worse and worse as that season went on, and ended up having easily the most widespread and severe drought in Iowa since 1936. Yeah, basically, it was an extremely busy time. I'd been actually in the office about 7 years before that doing research grants, but not as, it wasn't the state climatologist. And but by that spring of '88, we had a very warm and very dry spring, and things were looking pretty bleak, and it just got busier and busier and busier for a variety of reasons. We had kind of a historical summer. It was the hottest summer since 1936 and driest summer in parts of the state back to 36 as well. It was a very, very busy time. By far my worst year on the job, so to speak, was the first one as state climatologist.
Well, and a lot of jokes get passed around about Iowa weather this time of year because, it'll be 70 degrees one day and jump back to 25 degrees the next day. Has that made Iowa a particularly interesting place to do the studies you're doing?
Yeah, definitely is, because we certainly have probably not the most changeable weather any place in the world, but that distinction probably goes to the Dakotas, eastern Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, probably is in that ballpark. But we're very close to those states, obviously, and have very changeable weather. And, very cold winters, and at times very hot summers, just as hot as what I grew up with in Texas. Although the heat here is not nearly as persistent as it is down that way. But we can get it all, so to speak, as far as weather goes. And we do, kind of on a regular basis. And but in the spring, like we are right now, I think most Iowans have a kind of a too rosy of a picture of what spring should be like. We anticipate it should be nice and warm, at least most of the time, but it rarely is. It's usually a case where we have a lot of pretty cool, damp, cloudy weather through April, and a few nice days mixed in there. And so most of the time we're disappointed. We think this spring just isn't like we expect it should be, but usually it's fairly typical, really, for this time of the year, although this year is a bit different. We've had our coldest start to April in the historical record in 2018, so it's been a very, very cold start to the month of April, and of course we've been seeing pretty frequent snowfall events as well across the state for the last month or so, actually going back more than that, but been quite frequent, with more snow appearing to be on the way as well.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, planting season is beginning in a few days. What predictions do you have for Iowa farmers?
Generally, things are very cool right now. Soil temperature is very low, and so that might preclude any early planting ideas that farmers might have had, which has been possible to do quite a few times in recent springs, but certainly this year, much, much cooler situation. And biggest concern right now is how dry things are in parts of south central and southeast Iowa, roughly east of I-35 and south of I-80. It's not quite all of that area of the state, but kind of centered in Oskaloosa, Ottumwa, Bloomfield areas that have had two very dry years in a row, 2016 and 2017. And could really use a lot of soil moisture to get us in better shape yet before this growing season gets going, and make a little bit of progress with that. But still, it's a very dry part of the state, and kind of worrisome that they're already that dry and the season hasn't even got started yet. So that's the area of the state we'd really be keeping an eye on for this coming year. And overall, we're in a so-called La Nina weather pattern, which is expected to kind of peter out here in the near next month or two, but very often that general pattern from La Nina persists for much of the season, even though the phenomenon itself has kind of gone by the wayside. And traditionally, we tend to have drier than normal growing seasons in Iowa with La Nina, and especially during the summer months. So dryness might be a bigger issue this year than a more widespread issue, perhaps, than it has in much of the recent few decades.
Harry Hilliker, you've been Iowa's state climatologist for the last 30 years. We've certainly enjoyed talking with you and getting your analysis on Iowa Public Radio. Congrats so much on your retirement.
Well, thank you, Emily.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. We need to take a short break. We have a newscast coming up from IPR's Dennis Reese in just a moment. And afterwards, we're going to come back, get a preview of the United World Wrestling Men's Freestyle World Cup that's being hosted in Iowa City this weekend. I'll also talk with Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register about Ray Nareth, who passed away this week at the age of 106 years old. He had quite a life. We'll remember him coming up in a few minutes. Again, this is River to River from IPR. Stay with us.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of the show where we host quick conversations on Iowa news of the week. In a few minutes, I'll get a preview of the United World Wrestling Men's Freestyle World Cup that's being hosted in Iowa City this weekend. 8 teams from around the globe headed to Iowa City. First, let's head towards the Iowa State House, where Representative Megan Jones, a Republican lawmaker from Sioux Rapids, has been working for the past few months alongside her newborn baby, Alma Lucille. Representative Jones, thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll mention that this chapter of Alma's life has come to a close now that she's old enough for daycare, but she's been with you at the Iowa House since just a few weeks after her birthday on January 24th. Do you know whether you're the first lawmaker to do this at the Iowa Capitol?
I am not. I think in 2007, Janet Peterson, who's now the Senate Minority Leader, I think she was bringing her son Buck Henry in with her too.
Okay, and what led you to decide to bring Alma with you?
Well, we really didn't have a choice, quite honestly. My husband is a farmer, and so we have a small farm in Northwest Iowa, and coming in and out of machinery and working with cows, it was not physically an option for him to be having her with him all the time. My parents are both still working. Will's parents were in Texas, and so it left it up to me. And so she wasn't old enough to go to daycare yet. They have a 6-week requirement, and so she just came with me, and I wore her around the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. And I was at the Capitol a few weeks ago, and I saw her in a kind of a baby carrier on your chest, and she was just kind of, I think she was asleep. She was nodding off as you walked around, you know, talking with your caucus, with your colleagues. And she's been to committee meetings with you as well, right?
Yep. You know, we just tried to make the situation work as best as possible. And often that just meant me wearing her in a carrier around the Capitol. And, you know, being so young, she slept a lot. And so that worked out really well. In the gentle roar of the conversations happening at the Capitol, I think really kind of helped lull her to sleep many times.
Mm-hmm. Now, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, she announced earlier this year that she was pregnant. And, you know, with more women, we hear more women are running for office. We may see more mothers of young children in politics. Do you see support for new parents in office, or are there still some hurdles and kinks to work out? You know, I mentioned Senator Duckworth because the current rules in Washington prohibit her from bringing a baby onto the chamber floor.
Yeah, you know, I think probably when those rules were written, this just wasn't contemplated, or perhaps even to the point where women weren't contemplated to be in that chamber. So maybe some of our practices and procedures in that regard need to be updated. But, you know, I think there is so much support. I certainly experienced so much support from my colleagues on both sides of the aisle in this decision and what we had to do to make sure that we could still have a family and make sure that my constituents had a voice in Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from the experience?
You know, I really learned a lot about my colleagues on a personal level. I was able to work with them a little bit more on policy issues because I got to understand them and understand where they were coming from on a personal level. Many of them would share with me their stories about their grandchildren or children, about their trials and tribulations in raising a family and what they all had to experience. And I think it's really helped me and others connect on a different level. And that only helps us develop better policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you have a pretty unique situation with your job as a lawmaker because it requires you to be at the Capitol during the session. You know, you can't really schedule your maternity or paternity leave around that. But what advice do you have for expectant parents who would be interested in doing something similar?
You know, I think it's about communication, being open and honest with your employer and your customers and your clients. Letting them know, you know, what's all going on and your situation and how you're going to make it work. You know, this is a unique situation in that if I wasn't here, my constituents wouldn't have had a voice. So there's no proxy voting in the legislature. But, you know, I've heard from so many different small business owners and community leaders that said, hey, I was in a similar position and that's what I did too. Or, you know, this is how we made it work. So, you know, it's a lot about the communication and trying to be a little bit more creative about how to raise a family and work.
Mm-hmm. There's only a couple weeks left in the session, probably. And with Alma in daycare, is she headed back to Sioux Rapids or will she stay with you in Des Moines?
So she started daycare in Spencer on Monday. So she and our son go to daycare at the same place. So it's been a little bit lonely this week without her. And I've had many people at the Capitol ask how she's doing and kind of check up on her, which has been very nice to know that she was very loved here and that she kind of has a Capitol family here herself. But she's back home and my husband is taking her in the mornings and at night, and they're getting able to bond in that regard now.
Mm-hmm. And she'll have some really cool, unique pictures for her first few months of life. That's really great.
Certainly.
State Representative Megan Jones of Sioux Rapids. Representative Jones, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Iowa lost one of its most beloved bartenders this week. Ray Nareth passed away at the age of 106 years old. He worked at a state house in Dunlap at the Golden Slipper from the mid-1960s until he retired at the age of 103. Iowa columnist with the Des Moines Register, Kyle Munson, joins me now to remember Ray. Hi, Kyle. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, hey, Emily. Great to be here.
So when did you first meet Ray Nareth?
Well, I first met Ray, I walked into the Gold Slipper in Dunlap back in 2010, and there he was, this spry 98-year-old bartender, still working four nights a week, driving his Buick LeSabre, living alone, sleeping on the second floor of his house, hanging his laundry in the front yard. So, you know, he mixed up a pink squirrel and a grasshopper, and I was just instantly amazed just at his... just to how spry he was and the fact that he was he still loved to work as he's approaching 100.
Mm-hmm. Did he have any advice for what makes a good bartender when you spoke with him?
You know, I think he just loved to be around people. And even before his long run at the Slipper, he would bartend at another place in downtown Dunlap going back into the 40s. And he loved to play baseball. He was a lifelong Yankees fan. So I think a couple of the advice to friends would be, you know, hard work doesn't kill you. That's one thing he always said. Mm-hmm. And then he got a lot of exercise. He was always golfing, both locally, and then he'd take golf trips with, through the years, much younger and younger friends. They would go to Arizona or Florida. And he got, in the span of 18 years, he hit 3 holes in one. So he was a pretty good golfer, and I imagine his version of heaven involves both a quintessential Iowa supper club and a perfectly manicured golf course.
Mm-hmm. Now, he's 106 years old. That is quite a lifetime. And you wrote that he was actually born beneath, you know, not literally, but beneath a U.S. flag that only had 46 stars. Give me an idea of the things he's seen in his lifetime.
Yeah, you know, pretty remarkable. One is, I guess he had one of those classic 20th century lifespans, almost nearly spanning the entire 20th century. Back before we had 50 states, as you said, before World War I, of course, before the Titanic, before Henry Ford really got his assembly line up and running. Ray was in, he served over in India during World War II. He came back on Christmas Day of 1945. So just think of the first half of the 20th century that he experienced as he grew up, and, you know, not to mention that he continued to work into the 21st. So one of his former bosses at the Slipper, it was a great story of, you know, Ray was kind of a go-getter and not afraid to work, but he grumbled at some of the new technology. So the boss was telling me about having to teach Ray to use the credit card machine. And so Ray wasn't too fond of that, but he did it. He did it. It was okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what was his favorite drink to mix?
Well, he was pretty, I think he was known, people loved his ice cream drinks, but I'm not sure that was his favorite to mix, but he did a lot of them, sometimes begrudgingly maybe. But a lot of his buddies kept it simple, so he would just toss them a Bud Light and they were happy, and I think he enjoyed that, and he was able to have good conversation and not have to mess with all the ice cream.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does the Gold Slipper mean to the town of Dunlap? Having this restaurant, having a bartender who's been there for a long time, what does that mean to a town like that?
Well, you think about these small and rural communities. I was just at a summit in Grinnell this morning, where a rural summit, where communities are talking about the struggles of trying to retain people, attract a workforce, and on down the line. And so if you have a beloved, long-time supper club and social hub like the Gold Slipper or like other steakhouses around the state, the community takes pride in that. I mean, that one has survived different eras of ownership, and it's a gathering spot. It's that classic public house sort of a thing. So it becomes more important as the years go on and as the community is trying to, you know, stay viable and stay vibrant. Mm-hmm. So I think Ray being a part of that just highlighted that all the more, because here was somebody the town could rally around. And so in fact, he is being his services are today. He's being laid to rest today, and the funeral luncheon is at, of course, the Gold Slipper.
Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thank you for helping us remember Ray Nareth, who passed away this week at the age of 106 years old.
Thanks so much. A toast to Ray at all your happy hours today.
Cheers.
Cheers.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. This Saturday and Sunday, the best wrestlers on the top teams in the world will be in Iowa City for the United World Wrestling Men's Freestyle World Cup. Team USA and seven teams internationally will compete at the Carver Hawkeye Arena. Joining me now to preview the competition is KJ Pilcher. He's a wrestling reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Hi, KJ.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good. Gearing up for this weekend of competition. It should be fun down in Iowa City. I know they're expecting a good event. And it's not very often you get a world-class competition like this in your own backyard. So pretty excited for what the next couple days have in store.
Yeah, and quite a place for it. I mean, we know, you know, Iowa's a standout in wrestling in the U.S. How does the U.S. fare internationally against some of the teams they're going to be competing with this weekend?
Yeah, you know, I think the last few years, the United States have really kind of gained some steam. There's a lot of systemic changes and some format changes that have really benefited Team USA, and you've seen this kind of swelling of talent that has come through the pipeline, and they're coming off their first World Championships team title last fall, and the first one in like 22 years or so. We're really starting to see kind of this Team USA kind of reaching the brink of something really special. And talking to Jordan Burroughs, who's a five-time world champion and a 2012 Olympic gold medalist, he went so far as to say that this could be the beginning of a dynasty. That you're starting to see some of the talent coming through the pipeline, not just at the senior level, which this event's going to be this weekend, but even in the juniors, cadets, the younger age groups, and the women. That things are in place for this to not just be some recent success, but success that's going to last for a few years. And Team USA is a heavy favorite, I would say, this weekend. I think it's been documented that Russia is not going to make it. Iran, one of the mainstays in the World Cup competition, isn't going to be here, but they actually didn't even qualify originally from the World Championships and were only in the field because Turkey decided not to claim its spot. So, that kind of takes maybe a little shine off the entrance, as far as the entrant list, but Team USA really, really balanced, really, really depth. You see in kind of this resurgence of Team USA a little bit in talent, and they've added weight classes, so there are actually 10 weights now instead of like 6 or 7, and that allows Team USA to kind of get more talented guys that would be battling for one spot in the lineup, and that helps them a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit more. You mentioned Russia, and they were planning to be one of the 8 teams competing this weekend, but it sounds like they weren't able to obtain travel visas in time, and there's been some back and forth between the countries about what's happened. What happened here?
Well, I think there's probably a little more probably politics involved, more so than what the actual competitors and the federations, the USA Wrestling and the Russian Wrestling Federation, really had much say in how things played out. It just sounds like there's some kind of jockeying back and forth between pretty much those in charge of politics, and it just depends on who you ask, whether they were denied or things weren't done in time. But the unfortunate thing is, you know, probably the second best team out there in one of the perennial powers when it comes to international wrestling isn't going to be able to participate. And, you know, we've seen this in the past. We've seen, you know, the 80 Olympics where the United States weren't a part of it. We saw the 84 Olympics where Russia didn't come to Los Angeles. You know, and it's just an unfortunate situation. Even though if you ask the wrestlers, you know, they're just going to face whoever's in front of them, and it doesn't matter if it's Russia or Azerbaijan or Georgia or Japan or Cuba or Kazakhstan, Mongolia, whatever. You know, that's who they're going to face. And if it was up to the wrestlers on both sides, everybody would be involved. But I just think politics got in the way of competition here, and Russia, unfortunately, isn't going to make it.
Well, and there will be a Hawkeye representing back to Team USA, a Hawkeye representing Team USA this weekend, a 2017 World Silver Medalist, Thomas Gilman. Tell me about Gilman.
Yeah, you know, Thomas Gilman really has been impressive since, finishing up his college career at the University of Iowa. And we saw that really come into form when he was able to win the U.S. World Team spot against Tony Ramos, another former Hawk, last summer. And then he carried that on with that silver medalist performance that you talked about. And, you know, and he's, I think this is something that really suits him best. I think freestyle is kind of the discipline that he kind of thrives in, that style of wrestling, and he's done it at the junior level. You know, it's really no surprise, but, you know, he has an opportunity to really be a force for Team USA this weekend, you know, competing in his own backyard right in Carver. You know, of course, if you ask him, he says it doesn't matter where we're wrestling. He's the kind of guy that would, you know, really get excited for, you know, wrestling in his own backyard if he just laid down a blanket and had matches. So, but he was always kind of a spark plug for the team when he was with the Hawkeyes, and he kind of got that same role here with Team USA, being the first one out at 125 pounds. And, you know, he's going to be a real kind of a he calls himself a trailblazer when it comes to setting the tone for competitions, and I think he's going to have that same type of role and responsibility here this weekend as, you know, the United States starts off with India Saturday morning and then Japan Saturday afternoon, which would set up a rematch of the World Championship Finals between him and Takahashi of Japan. So really kind of looking forward to that. And he's got a really tough weight class here as well with, you know, competitors from India and Georgia and possibly Azerbaijan or Mongolia in the finals. So a real big weekend for him, but I think we'll see kind of a similar role that he played with the Hawkeyes going out there and really kind of setting the tone for the rest of the team.
We've been talking about the United World Wrestling Men's Freestyle World Cup. 8 teams from around the world will be in Iowa City competing this weekend at the Carver Hawkeye Arena. KJ Pilcher is a wrestling reporter for the Gazette. KJ, thank you for previewing this event with us.
No, thank you for having me, and keep up the great work.
And before we head out for this show, we want to hear a track that we can play on repeat this weekend. Mark Simmet, he's a senior music producer at Iowa Public Radio, is joining me now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Emily.
Hi. So the track you picked today to end the show is Jimi Hendrix's Mannish Boy. This is out of a new posthumously released album, Both Sides of the Sky. Before we take a listen to this track, tell me a little bit about this album.
Well, of course, Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, and almost immediately previously unreleased material started coming out and has continued off and on since 1970, and they're still doing it. The Jimi Hendrix family, his sister and other members of the family now control his music. So it's a bit better quality control these days, but one is still amazed that there remains previously unreleased Jimi Hendrix material after all these years. This new release called Both Sides of the Sky features just that, previously unreleased material. And this one is from 1969, and what struck me about it is that Jimi Hendrix makes this Muddy Waters song his very own. It's called Mannish Boy.
Jimi Hendrix. The track is Mannish Boy off the newly released album Both Sides of the Sky. Mark Simmet, thanks for introducing this song to us.
My pleasure, Emily.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Have a great weekend.